In the 1960s, the late Friedrich Hayek edited and also contributed to a really interesting book I recommend called Capitalism and the Historians. And in the introduction to this book, he basically says, you know, historical myths have as much of an impact on our society as historical truths. And I think that's correct. In other words, what we all know about history isn't necessarily what happened factually, but nonetheless, it continues to have a very large and outsized influence on us because the winners write the history. And so when we think about politics, when we try to understand politics or make sense of it, I think we have to consider two things. And first and foremost is that politics is just a substitute for violence. Politics is a form of war. It's a zero-sum game by definition. And we're seeing that in Washington. Someone wins and someone loses when Congress passes a bill or takes some sort of action or when courts impose a judgment. These bills, these court judgments aren't just aspirational idealizations of a good idea. They're enforced ultimately by people with guns and with prisons and jails. So once we start to understand politics as violence rather than some sort of process whereby we reach compromises and organize society, it begins to make a lot more sense to us. It's really just a turf battle. So when we talk about the Democrats versus the Republicans, we're not talking about an ideological or philosophical difference. What we're really talking about is a battle to control the apparatus of the state. And a lot of things make more sense when you consider it that way. It's the allocation of resources by violence, which is the opposite of market processes, or at least what market processes should be. But more than just violence, politics is about perception. Well, one thing I definitely learned in Washington, there really aren't facts in politics, there are only perceptions. For example, the widespread perception is that the left cares more about the poor than the right. That's a perception, and I think it's a pretty deeply ingrained one. But there aren't actual facts or truth in politics. So the game of politics is a game of shaping perceptions. And so whoever controls perceptions, whoever controls narratives, wins. I think some of you have probably heard of a blogger named Caitlin Johnstone. She's Australian. She's very active on Twitter, but a lot of her own stuff is on her Medium site. And she wrote a great article back in June called Whoever Controls the Narrative Controls the World. And so on the one hand, those of us who would like to see a more libertarian society, a society organized not around politics and the state, but around markets and civil society, on the one hand, we have platforms available to us today that we could never have imagined even 30 or 40 years ago. Virtually free platforms like Twitter and Facebook and all kinds of way to reach people with the press of a button, as opposed to using conferences like this or direct mail or video or whatever we had to do 40 years ago. But the problem is there's also so many more platforms. There's so many more outlets, so many more websites, social media feeds, etc., that it becomes more and more difficult to have a voice in all of this white noise. And a problem, I think, for all of us, I'm sure some of you in this room feel it, is we feel like we have to chime in on these silly social media things, because if we don't, someone else is chiming in, someone else is controlling it. So in that sense, it becomes like an arms race. And everyone feels like they have to have their say to try to have an impact. So what are some of the narratives that we're currently mired under that probably are more about perception than truth? Well, there's a lot of them. I think we saw in 2016, there was a narrative that Hillary Clinton was inevitable, that there's an arc to history, which sounds a lot like determinism. But nonetheless, if you're a progressive, you believe there's an arc to history and that things are inexorably moving in a certain direction. And that because of that, a sensible country is going to elect Hillary Clinton as president and not this crazy Donald Trump guy. Well, that arc of inevitability was shattered in that election, and I think it caused a lot of psychological damage because, again, there's a narrative, there's perception, something we all believe that just wasn't true. And so that psychological damage is still revealing itself in the almost unbelievable reactions we still see to Trump. I saw recently with this Jeff Bezos kerfuffle where he got himself in trouble with texting some pictures to his new girlfriend. And they were actually trying to lay this on Trump. and say somehow he's buddies with the National Enquirer guy, and he must have engineered all this because he hates Bezos. And now we find out it was maybe the girlfriend's brother or something. Who knows? But you know, it's just amazing how far people will go. Obviously, this Russian interference narrative is part of the same psychology. The other narrative is that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton were these radically different figures from these radically different ideological poles or something like that. I think that's very much untrue. I think if we look at what would have happened under Hillary Clinton administration and what is happening under Trump administration, if you don't look at the rhetoric, if we don't even look at I don't like the term policies of these two individuals, but if we look at what the federal civil service, what we should really think of as the government, which is about 2 million federal workers and maybe another 2 million military active duty. What those 2 million people get up and actually do each and every day is virtually unchanged. I don't think any of us would argue that things are much different from that perspective under Donald Trump than they would have been under Hillary Clinton. And I think there's also this bizarre narrative or perception that relative to past presidents, Trump is some sort of radical. And again, he may be radical in tone and style, but I don't think he is radical in substance relative to previous presidents. But here we are. This is the perception. And the perception really is what governs us. It's not a matter of facts or reality. But there's a problem here. The problem is that all of us in this room, we can't really escape it. We can't get away from this. In other words, you've heard the adage that politics has an interest in you. I don't like politics. I don't want to see libertarians necessarily focus on politics. To me, libertarianism means a world organized apart from politics. But I understand the desire or maybe even the need to engage in activism. I get it. And I wonder how many of you would agree with this. I would say, in my own experience, maybe 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, but certainly 10 years ago, I would still very much have said, you know, even the lowliest DMV clerk who's grumpy on the day you go in, or the, you know, a traffic cop who pulls you over, you know, state agents, even the lowliest state agent has more power over your life than any billionaire. You know, we should be entirely focused on state power. And corporations, you know, we all understand cronyism, we all understand regulatory capture, but for the most part, libertarians should focus on the state. And if corporations get big and powerful, that's because they're doing something right and providing a good or service that people actually want to buy. And there's a lot of truth to that. But I think we have to start to admit or acknowledge that what's happening between corporations and the state maybe ought to make us rethink that. And first and foremost, what jumps to mind is not only Amazon and the aforementioned Mr. Bezos, but social media platforms. Obviously, Twitter, Facebook, etc. are ostensibly private companies. They have private shareholders. They operate with a profit and loss statement like any other private company. But nonetheless, they are gatekeepers. They are guardians of the narrative, and they play an outsized role compared to a company that produces toilet paper or macaroni and cheese. Facebook and Twitter play an outsized role in determining that narrative and in shaping the perceptions that we all have to live with. And because politics comes after us, it gets interested in us. Someone's going to be president whether we vote or not. So when we start to look at these companies, we say, well, from a libertarian perspective, should they really enjoy the status they've got? Well, it's hard to say. It's not as cut and dried as maybe I would have thought 10 years ago. Some of you have probably heard of the Communications Decency Act, which was a bill passed in the 1990s. And one of the main authors of that was a congressman from California named Chris Cox, someone I actually knew a little bit. He represented a kind of a ritzy part of Orange County, California. And he was a pretty libertarian guy relative to other members of Congress. He was, you know, relatively well-read and that sort of thing, a thoughtful guy. And he got together with a Democrat named Ron Wyden from Oregon, who's kind of a left Democrat. And they said, you know, the internet in 1996 was this fledgling thing, and we need to exempt internet service providers and platforms from lawsuits for defamation, slander, or libel. And it made a lot of sense if you think about it at the time, because if people engage in a criminal conspiracy using their cell phones, let's say, we don't indict Verizon, their carrier, as a co-conspirator. We say, you know, the carrier's neutral. And if two people get together via Craigslist, let's say, and meet up and then go and engage in maybe illicit drug activity, illicit prostitution, something like that, I think we all understand, you know, it's not really Craigslist's fault. Craigslist is simply a website where people can connect. So in Chris Cox's conception back in the 90s, we need to carve out an exception for these pure intermediaries. Intermediaries which are merely conveying information, but not producing it or editing it or having any editorial control. And I think that was correct for the time. But what's interesting about that that federal law, which passed, is that it also preempted any state laws. So the Communications Decency Act also prohibits you from suing Facebook, let's say, in your own state courts, which is a little bit different thing. That's something I would argue that Congress ought not to have the authority to do. Well, Congress doesn't have the authority to do anything, but here we are. So not only do they have this legal shield when it comes to defamation lawsuits, but now we find out that they are exercising editorial control. They are deciding who gets to have a voice. And even if you do have a voice, there are certain things you can't say. So that sounds an awful lot like a newspaper or a publisher to me. That's a little different, isn't it? When you kick Alex Jones off your platform, that's basically an editorial statement that he's beyond the pale, or his social media content is beyond the pale. Okay. And I don't disagree that a private platform, a lot of people poured money and time and effort into creating a platform like Facebook, which is free to us, it's ad supported. I don't disagree in principle with the idea that they should be allowed to exclude who they wish, but saying that they are immune from defamation lawsuits is a little bit different thing, because they're not acting as pure intermediaries. And I also noticed that this argument about doing what you want with your own property doesn't extend across the board to all so-called public accommodations. In other words, Facebook and Twitter are actively going after certain people, in my view anyway, for their ideological perception or stance or statements. Well, how far are we going to take that? Are hotels allowed to do that? Are restaurants allowed to do that? Are schools allowed to do that, private schools? I mean, this seems to me like we have entered a new era where we don't just have crony companies, which we've always had, which was kind of a one-way street. Like, let's say you're a pharmaceutical company. You install a bunch of lobbyists into position, former lobbyists into positions at the FDA, and you create what's called regulatory capture, which makes it so that your particular drug gets pushed along and approved faster, and the competitors' drugs are still, you know, left out there in the wilderness, and as a result, you enjoy this nice 30 years of patent protection for your drug, and it costs a lot of money as a result. Okay, we see people using government to enrich themselves, but now it's flipped to an extent, and government is using social media platforms to enrich itself, to forward the narratives it wants to forward and shape perception. Now, this is a little different. You know, we know that a lot of these companies are in bed quite a bit with the government, with the federal government, that Amazon is providing cloud services to organizations like NSA and the Department of Defense. We know that Zuckerberg at Facebook has worked very closely with people like Angela Merkel in Germany to tone down anti-immigrant sentiment, for example, on Facebook in Germany. We know Zuckerberg has partnered with some NGOs, some very shady NGOs, to help him determine what sort of content should be allowed on Facebook. Those same NGOs are at least in part funded by the US federal government. So we reached this point where, as liberty-minded people, I think it's safe and I think it's fair to begin to view some of these private companies as political enemies, because they sure as hell are acting like it. So why should we be so meek? Why should we be so timid? If we've learned anything from Trump, It's that politics is blood sport. You can engage in it or not engage in it, I suppose, but if you're going to engage in it to win. So here's the thing when it comes to blood sport. The blood sport of crafting narratives and creating perception is that, as Dr. Gary North says, something always beats nothing. Something beats nothing. And so this is why I've been surprised lately by some of the reactions to what's going on in Washington. I'm sure you've been following to an extent Bernie Sanders, Senator Kamala Harris, some of these other presidential hopefuls, and of course, the new Congresswoman from New York, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, has come out with her Green New Deal, which is not only bold in terms of what it purports to enshrine into law someday. It's not only bold, it's crazy. I mean, we're talking about literally getting rid of fossil fuels in America in the next 10 or 20 years. We're talking about literally getting rid of hundreds of coal and nuclear plants in the United States over the next 10 or 20 years, and we're all driving electric cars. I mean, things like this are so outlandish that, you know, it's easy to laugh at it and to think, you know, I'm sure all these people in Orlando are going to be just fine with no air conditioning, you know, while we get through this fossil fuel shutdown. But what's so interesting to me is that when we take Gary North's dictum that something always beats nothing, you know, this is actually a brilliant proposal. Because if you're interested, you know, libertarianism and to a lesser extent Austrian economics, they always feel like they're more forbearance than action. Do you ever get this sense that we're always talking about what we don't want people to do rather than what we do want them to do? So it's a more difficult sell to people, because if you're a progressive, you can just say, oh, I want equality. I want everyone to be happy. I want everyone to have free healthcare, whatever it is. You know, that's a much easier sell than saying, I want government to not trample your rights. I want state agencies to not interfere in the economy. There's sort of a negative versus positive polarity to our arguments. So when we think that, you know, something always beats nothing, well, when you start saying we're going to get rid of fossil fuels, we're going to get rid of billionaires, I don't know how we do that, we're going to have 70% marginal tax rates, we're going to have no more nuclear and coal plants, we're going to have all racial reparations, we're going to have all kinds of things, we're going to have free college, we're going to have free Medicare for all. You know, that say what you will, that's something. That's not nothing. And if we go back to politics as self-interested blood sport, if we go back to it as war, you know, people want things. They want stuff for free. They want something for nothing. This is human nature. So it actually makes a lot of sense when we view it that way. And as an aside, a quick aside, because politics is war by other means, that's why charges of hypocrisy and whataboutism, that's why it doesn't work. Whataboutism doesn't work. When all the billionaires fly to Davos in their private jets and talk about climate control, there's always, reliably, there's always five articles about, oh my gosh, we've got all these billionaires in their private jets which produce all these carbon emissions. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Hypocrisy in politics is like, it's like pointing out a soldier in a trench in the middle of a battle has dandruff or something. There's no such thing as hypocrisy in war. It's just a tactic. It's just part of it. So it doesn't matter. When Trump declares an emergency over the wall, and we say, oh, you know, that's a really bad precedent for limited government, because what kind of emergency can we set in the future? It doesn't matter. This is trench warfare. And this is really what libertarians don't get. And if we understand that something beats nothing, then I have to be a little puzzled, because I've seen some people who are normally pretty perceptive about politics react to her, to especially this Green New Deal, and say, oh my gosh, this is fantastic. This time they've gone too far. Joe Sobern used to say that. We've heard that one before. You know, Pat Buchanan, of all people, who say, you love him or hate him, he's an astute political observer. Pat Buchanan wrote this article called, Are the Democrats Bent on Suicide? I don't know. And there's a woman, Kimberly Strassel at Wall Street Journal, I'm sure some of you know. She basically said, oh my gosh, this Green New Deal is such a gift to the conservatives. It's almost as though Republican lobbyists went out and wrote this as a parody of the Democrats just to win votes. And, you know, it could be a GOP fake bill. And I have to say, I really disagree. I disagree. I think when you're talking about something, you're moving towards it. You know, Murray Rothbard had this great, and this is a paraphrase, it's not his exact words, but he had this great idea that Democrats engineer the great leaps forward, you know, the New Deals and the Great Society, and then Republicans come along and consolidate the gains. So I think that's what's happening. I think, you know, you float an outrageous trial balloon, and then the fallback position seems reasonable. And we've seen this time and time again. That's this 20th century, baby. It's called incrementalism. If you had told someone in 1900, in 1900s, Americans were still hard-bitten, pragmatic, tough people. Okay? If you had told someone in 1900, in the next century, we are going to have a central bank. We're going to have old age pensions called Social Security. We're going to have free old age health care called Medicare. We're going to have the Great Society programs. We're going to have all kinds of judicial activism. In 1900, people would have laughed you out of the room. But we got all that nonetheless. They might not have lived long enough to see it, but we got it anyway. And if there's one thing the left's good at, it's playing the long game. Got to hand it to them. And you know, Murray Rothbard really believed that liberty was, incrementalism didn't work, that incrementalism was a one-way street. And that if you're going to fight against this progressive monolith, that you have to be bold. And we have to do things that they do. We have to fight fire with fire. So the question becomes, you know, what is our something? If something beats nothing, what's our something? Is it Gary Johnson? Is it getting rid of the federal income tax? Is it eliminating drug laws? You know, again, all of these are kind of negative. We have to think, what is our something? And freedom, what we would say, that's our something, Jeff. Our something is freedom. Allowing markets and civil society to flourish, allowing individuals to live as they see fit, as long as they're not harming anyone else. That's our something, and that's the greatest something in human history. And as a matter of fact, it's the most radical and newest thing in human history, because for centuries and centuries, we had tribes or kings or central governments, and now what we're suggesting, what we're promoting is the next thing. That's modernity. Okay, and I agree. But how do we sell it? What is our something? Because don't forget, the left has a something. As dissolute as we might think they are, now I could talk about the right, we'll do that in another talk sometime. But as dissolute as they are, as jaundiced as they are, as amoral as they are, the left does have a something, and that something is egalitarianism. That is the animating something behind everything the left says or does. Now, a lot, oftentimes they don't really mean it. Oftentimes they don't even believe it themselves. Oftentimes they don't care if the policies and ideology they promote actually creates more poverty and more inequality. They don't care, because good intentions are everything. It's a great being on the left, isn't it? You just wake up every morning and say, I mean well. Man, I'd love to have that. But that's their something. Paul Gottfried has written about this at length. You know, we are too dismissive of the left sometimes. They have an anchoring principle. And what do conservatives have? What does the right have? They're totally incoherent. I mean, I don't consider Trump a conservative or a Republican much. He's blown the whole thing out of the water, of course. But what do they have? What is the animating principle other than opposing the, we're against this Green New Deal, it's crazy. Air conditioning, that's something. I'll take that. But it's not enough to base a political movement off. So what's their something? You know, have you ever heard a conservative say in the last 10 or 20 years, you know, Democrats are about welfare and dependency. We are the party of opportunity and ownership. We don't want you to be a schlub. We want everyone to rise. We're the party that wants you to own stuff. We want you to have a house. We want average people who make $40,000 a year, we want them to be invested in the stock market. We want schools to be better and more market-based. We want healthcare costs to come down and be more market-based. Just like the cost of LASIK eye surgery, which is cash, of course, has come down. Just like the price of a DVD player used to be $1,000, now it's $40 at Walmart. That's how we want medicine to be. We want people to have opportunities and ownership and excellence. And we want to be for striving and achievement instead of dependency and welfare like those other guys who want to keep you stuck on the plantation. They never say that. I don't really know what conservatives say today. I don't understand. I don't much get what their animating principle is, what their something is. So I'll just leave you with this. We got to have a something. And whether that's cultural, whether that's social, whether that's economic, whether that's political, we all have our own interests, our own talents, but it's got to be a something. For me, I think that something is breaking up. I personally think that trying to get 70 million people, which is about what it would takes to elect someone to national office, to the presidency of this country, for example, trying to get a Rand Paul or someone elected president, 70 million votes, I think is an awful, awful, tough uphill climb. But getting somebody halfway decent elected to a state or a region, I think is a lot more doable. So that's my something. I believe in radical decentralization. I believe in federalism. I believe in secession. I believe in issue coalitions. Anything that sort of breaks up this painful kidney stone we call Washington. So that's my something, but it doesn't have to be your something, but we all need something. Thanks very much.